Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to UFO Think Tank with your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Mis amigos on this planet or any other, because I am of the belief, people, that they're not all bad out there. They could be all good, but I think that's a possibility, actually. And, you know, I may be naive in that, but I think it is entirely possible. And here's why I believe that is, you know, if they're advanced enough to get to not destroy each other, then maybe, you know, they're advanced enough to move beyond the stars. I think that's the point where we're at. If we can manage not to kill each other and see that we need to work together and live together, then maybe we will be able to survive long enough to build the technology for interstellar travel. Just a theory. I could be wrong. It could be that there's bad and good out there, just like there is down here. And they're relative terms anyway, I guess, right, people? So who knows, a lot going on. Anyway, this is Alejandro T. Rojas, your host for UFO Think Tank. You can go to ufothinktank.com and tell me what you think. All right, go to my Facebook, which is UFO Think Tank, and tell me what you think. I'm loving Facebook, and thank you to all my Facebook buddies. In fact, our guest tonight is one of my Facebook buddies. His name is Ricky Butterfast. Actually, I've known him for quite some time, many years now. And he's mostly comes to our events representing Stephen Greer and the CSETI group, not just the Disclosure Project, which I know many of you are aware of. I've got my bumper sticker in front of me here on my cork board in my office, but because the Disclosure Project is what got me into all of this at disclosureproject.org. All these witnesses that Mr. Greer got together, it's phenomenal. But he also has a group called CSETI, which is the Center for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And this group actually has an ambassador program where they go out and they have some protocols to call in UFOs. And in fact, I'll get into it a little later, but I tried this protocol and I had my first sighting. And look, baffles me as much as it baffles anybody else that this actually, they correlated. Could be coincidence, but is it? I don't know. So it's hard to say. All I can say is, as nutty as it may sound to some people, I tried this protocol and I saw a UFO along with many other people. So I'll talk about that in a minute when we bring Ricky on. I think I've told him that story, but I'll tell him again. He's going to have to listen to it again. But Ricky is part of the CSETI group. He goes out and does these things, so he'll talk about that. But Ricky, I called him a UFO ET adventurer on the site because he has an extraordinary life that he's lived, and I should have probably mentioned a little more. He's got a whole career lifetime on looking into alternative energies. One of the really interesting things we'll talk about is back in 73, the year I was born, actually, now you know how old I am. he was working with different airline companies as an engineer to create a liquid hydrogen propelled jet instead of using fuel, oil. So very interesting there. He also since then has been working on an electromagnetic ramjet. So working on some other type of propulsions that can get us off of our dependency on fossil fuels. He's been doing that for decades, working as an engineer. He's been part of the Planetary Society. He's got to meet with Carl Sagan. He's actually been part of the International Association for New Sciences. Well, he got to at least work with them and talk, and then actually a group I work with and was representing last weekend. I'll get into that in a minute, too. And, of course, he's worked with Dr. Greer. In fact, he's working on bringing Dr. Greer to come to Denver to speak in just a few days here. In fact, just this Thursday on the 18th, Dr. Greer will be speaking downtown. You've heard me talk about my cousin and the Crypto Science Society. They will be hosting him at the Auraria campus downtown. So very exciting stuff. If you live here in Denver, you're definitely going to have to check that out. That's $10. We'll talk more about that as well. So this is going to be a great talk. I know, you know, Ricky and I don't see eye to eye on everything, and maybe we'll talk about some of that stuff too, because he's got an incredible life, and I love to hear his opinion on some of these things. But he was also in the Navy, went to a Naval Aviation School, a pilot. So lots of really cool stuff to talk about. We'll be talking about that in just one moment. However, to begin, let's get into our UFO news for the week, as usual. Some of the things that I've got up here, we haven't actually talked for a while, right, guys? You missed me last weekend, I hope, because I missed you, you know, whether or not you missed me, I was thinking of you. I know you were. But anyway, what I was doing is actually helping Jeff Peckman. So you may be aware of his ballot initiative here in Denver to have Denver create an extraterrestrial affairs committee. And he thinks that, you know, as responsible government, that Denver should be looking into this serious subject and seeing how it affects Denver and share that information with the public and be prepared if preparation's necessary. So he's working. He needs to get 4,000 signatures in the Denver County area in order to get this on the ballot, and then Denver citizens will be able to vote on whether or not they want this committee to exist. Some people were saying, well, you know, we're going to spend taxpayer money on this. Well, we're spending a lot of taxpayer money on this subject. If you're not aware, at least I'm convinced the military is. However, if you still have that concern, actually the way Jeff had wrote this is that this committee will exist off of grants and donations and gifts, so it won't cost the taxpayers anything for this committee to operate. To alleviate some of those concerns, and you can go to extracampaign.com to find out more about this. He is also the Denver UFO Examiner at examiner.com, which we've talked about quite a bit around here as well, and he has a lot of events going on in the next few months where you can go to sign this. So really, if you're in Denver, I think it would be great. You know, and he's got some really good points that whether or not this passes, if he's able to get his, and I'm sorry, that's extracampaign.org, extracampaign.org. Whether or not this passes, if he's able to get his 4,000 signatures, the media worldwide is really going to be focused on this. Just like any ballot initiative out there, there will be school children and schools, they'll be talking about this in their politics classes, and they'll be debating, you know, whether or not we should have this committee or not. So it's really going to get the word out there, and it's just going to bring more of a focus to this subject if he's able to do it. So I think that's kind of exciting. So that's why last weekend I volunteered to do the work to get the table for him at the People's Fair, which is the biggest festival in the Denver area. Hundreds of thousands of people come to this. and make sure that that table was manned. And we did it. So we had a table last weekend, and we got hundreds of signatures. And we had a lot of fun in the process. In fact, you can go to YouTube, and actually I have it up on UFOthinkTank.com. You can go there and look at my YouTube site, and you'll be able to see a video that someone took out there where they videotaped what we were doing, and I did a short interview, Jeff did a short interview. So that was a lot of fun. So check it out, and definitely if you're in the Denver area, help out. And if you're in Facebook, you can go look up Extra Campaign too, and there's a group that you can join there. So pretty cool stuff. Pretty cool stuff. Other UFO news. Well, we've had some neat things going on. Speaking of Examiner.com, actually this week was really exciting with Examiner.com, and I probably should credit, because I think it has to do partially with Stephen Bassett. He had sent out a bunch of stuff to us, some of us on Examiner and others, and said, hey, everybody write articles, you know, here and there, and we'll flood the media with so many articles that hopefully something will happen. So, you know, I said, what the heck? I want to write an article on, he wanted us to write on, especially oriented around politics. And I think that the Obama, you know, if you've heard our Grant Cameron interview, I think that stuff is incredible. The Obama administration and their connections to the UFO disclosure through John Podesta, the guy in charge of his project to transition power to Obama from Bush, and then also with Hillary Clinton and her history, and the history of Lawrence Rockefeller. And we're not talking about this black sheep of the Rockefeller family. We're talking about one of the, capital T-H-E, bold, underlined, Rockefellers. And, you know, he sat on the New York Stock Exchange. He was in charge of their humongous fund. And he got into UFO disclosure and trying to help that happen, which is kind of interesting because no doubt he's got the resources to kind of make it happen whether the government wants it or not, you would think, but I don't know. So anyway, but that was during the Clinton administration, and he worked with Hillary to present all this information to the president. And there is information and freedom of information letters that Grant Cameron received to prove that to be the case. So I wrote that story in Examiner, some other examiners. Jeff, of course, wrote a story. Niara, who I had on the show not too long ago, wrote a story about the astronauts and them talking about UFOs. And so we had a bunch of stories in the Examiner, and we really were able to flood the media and have a lot of stories out there. And all of our stories got looked at a lot. So that was really exciting. So that's some of what you'll see out there in the news. Also, Roger Marsh, the UFO, National UFO Examiner, of course, has tons of stories he's posted, and so I'll go through some of these. Orange Fear over an Ohio highway he wrote about, and these come from the MUFON files. He also wrote about an orange light hovering over a Florida home, 20 UFOs. Well, let's see, what else is this? UFOs being spotted near a plane. Triangle UFOs videotaped over Maryland, and a squadron of UFOs reported over Idaho. And then just today I posted dark object hovers over South Carolina beach. And he also gave some updates to some of the UFO sightings that have been up there, where actually he's keeping in contact with the MUFON investigators, and once they close their cases, he is reporting their findings. So definitely want to check that out. You can see these links, by the way, at UFOthinkTank.com, and look under UFO News, and you'll see all of this. Or you can go to Yahoo Groups and look for UFO Think Tank and see it there. Or you could go to my Facebook, because I make sure that those go there as well. Some other interesting files, you know, Michael Sala had written on Kennedy being linked to USSR space missions with classified UFO files. Supposedly, this was some documents that were found where Kennedy was working with Russia, so we would have a joint space program. And supposedly some information out there about Kennedy wanting to also share UFO files with Russia. So that was pretty interesting story. UFOs being seen in Brazil. And then also all UFO secrets being revealed, supposedly. All NewsWeb I've been talking about a lot. It's a news source that brings together lots of news stories and posts them, and they've been writing a lot about UFOs lately, where one of their writers has started a series saying that he's been investigating this stuff for 6 years. Since he's been writing on this, he's had a lot of insiders send him information, and he's got it all figured out, and he's writing these stories saying, here's what's going on, guys. So he's got these stories on All News Web where he's revealing everything he knows, and he says this is the fact, and this is what is going on, and he's got it all figured out, and all you have to do is read his stories, and you'll know everything as well. He kind of comes from the angle that the government doesn't know much, essentially, and they know as much as we do, so that's why they don't release information. Interesting theory. So, of course, when anybody says they got it all figured out, this is my kind of rule of thumb, is if someone says they have it all figured out, then it's probably not the person to listen to, because if they say, here's what I know, I don't have it all figured out, but this is what I've been able to figure out, those are usually people that I like to listen to a little more, because, you know what, even with this gentleman, every researcher finds out that, wow, here's a whole new avenue I didn't even know about, so maybe I didn't have it all figured out. I think we all feel that way in every field that we're in. But yeah, Fox News actually wrote about 20 UFOs being spotted flying in formation over England, and there are some pictures that were taken, and you can see these on the web, including on Fox News. So very interesting pictures. The pictures are hard to make out, you know, like most, they're just lights in the sky. So were they stars? It's hard to tell, just a still picture. But there are lots of witnesses who saw this and say there was a squadron of these UFOs flying around up there. So kind of cool stuff. You'll have to check that out. Also, this is really funny. Stanton Friedman, of course, famous ufologist, probably the most famous ufologist. He's on TV often. He's the physicist with the beard. A really interesting guy. He is a lot of fun. If you've never heard him talk, and I would be surprised if you're in this field and you haven't heard him talk, because he's all over the place giving talks. And he's, like I said, the most popular ufologist. But he's really funny guy. The way he puts it is very straightforward. He's been on Larry King even recently many times. So, but anyway, they were with him and Kathleen Martin. Kathleen Martin is actually the niece of Betty Hill. Betty and Barney Hill were the first case of people being abducted, if you want to look into that, in the 60s, if you're not aware. But they were interviewing Kathleen Martin and Stanton Friedman in the dark in one of the locations where Betty and Barney Hill believe they were taken. And in the background, you see these lights start to flicker on and off. They turn around and look, and they see these two lights, Kathleen says, flying in formation, and then they break apart and fly in two different directions. And they were pretty fabriglassed. And it's so funny because it's in this video where they were interviewing Stanton Friedman and Kathleen Martin, and Stanton turns around and says, I'm not saying those are extraterrestrial. So pretty funny stuff. You'll have to check it out. Pretty interesting stuff, of course. Speaking of interesting videos, more videos from Istanbul. If you're familiar with some videos that these gentlemen are taking in Turkey, they're in that city. These guys are security guards, so they're outside a lot. And they've taken these amazing videos periodically. They have some great equipment where they're able to zoom in. And you see this very strange kind of half, looks like an empanada, if you know what that is, kind of a half circle type of craft with an opening in the middle. And these guys believe that what you're seeing in the opening is a couple extraterrestrials sitting there in the driver's seats flying this thing around. But some very interesting video. It's very clear, but they've been taking this video on and off for the last couple of years, and actually they have this video that they just took a few weeks ago posted on the internet. So some interesting video from Turkey that you'll be able to see. And let's see, a story actually that I broke last weekend was Roswell Sci-Fi Channel, Roswell Dig information. So if you're aware of the Roswell Digs, that was a Sci-Fi Channel TV show where Brian Kimball hosted it. And they came, they had found some stuff, but they never talked about what they had found. And often people are asking me, you know, do you know what they found in Roswell? Did they ever check that stuff out? And they hadn't. Well, my buddy Chuck Zukowski was part of the Roswell Digs. He went out with them, and he's been following this. So keeping a close eye, and because of a bunch of different stuff, the material hasn't been available to analyze. There were, you know, NBC bought Sci-Fi, and they were thinking of shooting another episode to show the analysis of this stuff, but they never ended up shooting that television show. So nobody found out what happened. Well, Chuck worked with Dr. Dolman, who was the head archaeologist on the dig, and they were able to get a hold of this stuff, and now they're seeking analysis. So Dr. Dolman wrote a paper outlining everything they had found and what it was, what it appeared to be, and what they didn't know. And so they allowed me to post that analysis by Dr. Dolman along with the pictures of the objects, and I give an update on what they're looking into. So you can see that at my Denver Paranormal Science Examiner.com, and that's also posted in those areas I mentioned before. So very interesting stuff. Some of it is pretty mundane, such as rubber from a shoe. But as Dr. Dolman said, you know, we need to treat this area like a crime scene and investigate everything. If, you know, one of the most amazing things ever in our history happened in this location and an extraterrestrial craft crashed, we need to look into every aspect of that, because what if the type of rubber on that shoe shows us that it was this particular military unit, or anything indicates some sort of something in the area that shouldn't have been there that leads us to discover more about what happened, just like you would do in a criminal case. So he's got some good arguments. I'm helping them seek some people to look into that for them, and hopefully we'll have some more information soon. But finally, you know, we've got these materials, we know what they are, and we can start to look into those. So that's good stuff. Well, that is my news for the week, ladies and gentlemen. Let us get on to Mr. Ricky Butterfast. And speaking of fast, it's actually fast, but it sounds like fast. I got to fastly type in, if that's a word, his phone number here. Click add. Click OK. And through the magic of our technology, any second now... There's a ring.
Hello.
Is this Mr. Ricky Butterfast?
It is.
Hello, it's Alejandro.
Hello, Alejandro.
My news took a little longer than I thought, I guess. I had a lot of UFO news to update the people on.
Well, that's good.
Well, it's good to talk to you. I've mentioned, you know, your background and what you've done. And to start off, I would like to talk about, you know, some of this incredible alternative propulsion type of stuff that you've been working on, beginning with the liquid hydrogen. Was this like liquid hydrogen jets that you were working on in 73?
No. It's, with United Airlines.
Right.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was working with United Airlines at the time. This is when the oil embargo came on. I don't know if you recall or not, but that was back when Jimmy Carter was in office. Well, actually, Nixon. And I had been working on converting jet aircraft to burn liquid hydrogen. And I got together with United Airlines and talked to them about it, and was promoted to the maintenance base in San Francisco. And I talked to the engineers out there, and they did a 2.5-year feasibility study with McDonnell Douglas on the DC-10, and with Lockheed. Lockheed was at the time had vast experience with the RS-71 and of course X-15 before that, and McDonnell Douglas and United were going to take the DC-10 and stretch it out to make it a stretch version, and they're going to take cryogenic spheres with liquid hydrogen in it and put it in midships and be over the wing root center of gravity there. And they were going to burn liquid hydrogen instead of petroleum or jet fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And they worked on that feasibility study for 2.5 years. But what happened was is that Richard Nixon got together with OPEC and Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis agreed to open up the spigot on the oil flow and to break the embargo if the United States would provide them military support in case the other OPEC nations would retaliate against them militarily. And of course, when that happened, they opened up the oil, and then the prices dropped, and then it became no longer feasible for the airlines to go on with that study to convert all their aircraft over to burn liquid hydrogen.
Is that dangerous to burn liquid hydrogen in a commercial plane?
No, it's not. Actually, liquid hydrogen, hydrogen and gas itself, isn't really volatile until it's mixed with oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
So, everybody refers to the Hindenburg, the dirigible that was back in the 30s,
right.
Got hit by lightning. And, well, there's controversy around that and conspiracy. Well, there's all kinds of things about the Hindenburg. But the Hindenburg burned. It didn't blow up. If you would take the same amount of gasoline and hit it with a bullet, it'd blow up. And that's what they use in the movies, and that, when they have these big balls of flames going up in the air, it's usually gasoline.
Hmm.
But so hydrogen is pretty stable. Matter of fact, the stability of hydrogen gas itself, I've seen an arm of personal shell hit a canister of hydrogen, and it didn't do a thing to it. And the only way they could show that in the experiment that it was actually had gas in it, that they had a propane line out there to lit to show that the gas was coming out of it. So it's really pretty stable unless it's mixed with oxygen. On an aircraft, if they use liquid hydrogen, and of course, if the two combined there, it could be volatile, but no more volatile than gasoline, for sure. But what that would do is the thing about, I told United about it, that they could get on liquid hydrogen, they could run the hydrogen lines around the turbine. And I don't know if you're familiar with jet engines, but the exhaust gases come out the back end through the nozzle, and there's a turbine that the exhaust gas is hit, and that turbine drives a compressor. So that and the fan blades on the ducted fans, it's like a propeller. So that adds to propulsion. But because there's high temperature on the turbine blades, then they sometimes have a fatigue factor that's increased because of the temperature, and they can fail. But by ducting the liquid hydrogen before it's inserted into the engine, the liquid hydrogen is pretty cold. I don't know if you're familiar how cold it is, but I think it's around 275 or something below zero Fahrenheit. I can't recall if that's correct or not, but it's around the neighborhood. It's pretty cold. So ducting around the exhaust gases cools the exhaust gases, therefore the turbine life would be extended and they get more use out of the engine. Plus, there's no pollution coming out. There's no nitrous oxides or, you know, nitric acid that can be injected into the...
Is anybody looking into that now, do you know?
I don't think so. I'm pretty sure not, because that was, well, how, you know, that's been, what, 36 years ago?
Yeah.
I doubt if they're even doing it. The Russians did get, they have a version of a three-engine. In pilot talk, they call it a three-holer, but it's a three-engine like the 727. That they got the top engine and the tail working on hydrogen, and they had a flying. So they get that aircraft up to cruise, and then they turn off the jet fuel engines and cruise just on that one on hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, OPEC found out about that, and they figured, wow, if all the airlines on the planet started doing that, you know, that would really cut into their sales, and the demand would really drop. So Nixon cut that deal with Saudi Arabia to get the oil flowing. And, of course, then it was all honky-dory until the Gulf War, the first Iraq War. And, see, that's when that happened, when Saddam Hussein went into Kuwait and took that over. We said, oh, you know, we really don't care all that much, blah, blah, blah. You know, that was the controversy at that time. And the only thing is, Saudi Arabia says, well, wait a minute, they're right there. They're going to have Saddam Hussein's going to have a port facility that he's going to be able to pump out his oil and put it onto the market. We're going to lose our market share. Then again, he might, he's a Shia and we're Sunni, so he might get enough arms and enough wealth to go into Saudi Arabia. So they saw that as a direct threat. So they got President George W.H. Bush, you know, the first Bush president, to commit to that agreement that they made with Nixon on the defense of Saudi Arabia. So that's what started the first Gulf War. But then again, they did this just like they did in Vietnam. Excuse me. Is that they only went to where the oil fields, most of the oil fields were in the southern hemisphere, or this, you know, the south, and then there were some in the north. So that was in the fly zones that they had in Iraq. You know, so they had Saddam Hussein really defeated then.
Hmm. So, all right. I also wanted to get in, then next you started to work on three-stage fusion electromagnetic ramjet, and you were doing that for quite some time. What is that?
Okay, well, that goes clear back to when I was in high school. I can see it there. I got the senior class award for in industrial arts for the research I was doing on Major Dushevsky. I don't know if you know who he is, but he came up with the ionocraft. And basically, the ionocraft is a device that's envisioned, you know, just a bed springs and then some antennas sticking up over the bed springs. So the bed springs are the cathode or the negative terminal, and then the aerial sticking up are the emitters or the anodes. And what that does is it ionizes the air molecules and gives it a charge, and then, of course, the base is has an opposite charge, and so it magnetically attracts the ionized air molecules above it, and you got airflow, so it basically could levitate that way. You can probably do a Google on the ship Major Dushevsky. There was an article in 64 or 65, I can't recall now, it's been quite a long time ago, in Popular Mechanics, I think, or the Popular Science, that did a whole article about it. And so basically I could see that as a propulsion system. So I incorporated that into a design theory on the classic flying saucer, the disc. And I used technology that was cutting edge, advanced technologies, and some theory to design a electromagnetic fusion ram scoop. And if you are you familiar with the buzzard ram scoop, the buzzard ramjet?
No, I'm familiar with the ramjet.
Yeah. Well, this is the buzzard ramjet, and Dr. Buzzard came up with the idea that you could use a big scoop in space about 1,000 miles in diameter and collect enough free hydrogen to burn it in a nuclear reactor and use it for propulsion. But when I was with the National Space Institute, I theorized that instead of if you use the technology that Major Jastrzebski used, whereas you would take a jet engine, a collector scoop, and then have inside of it some braces that you could actually, where the emitters and ions project an ionization field out in front of it. And in the atmosphere, what that would do is it would ionize the air molecules, and then the scoop would be there as well. And then in the you'd have just a regular ramjet where you have the diffuser and it goes through the Venturi effect and then, you know, compresses. And then I had thermal radiators inside that would detonate the gas. But what this would do was take the water molecules within the atmosphere and divide them into oxygen and hydrogen. And then it would ionize it and then be attracted inside the scoop and go through the diffusion, be compressed, and then you could actually detonate it. And instead of using petroleum, you would use just regular water vapor in the atmosphere.
Wow. And the ion, is that similar to the lifters? Have you seen lifters?
Well, there's...
So I've seen those lifters where you... and if anybody wants to go, you could go to AmericanAntiGrav.com and see... where they create, they put the tinfoil on the bottom and then the a line where they highly charge it, and they create an ionic wind to make these little balsa things float.
Yeah, that's the basic design for the ionic craft. And I think they got some flying. A lot of people kind of see this thing that looks like a toroid, and it's got these big antennas sticking up in the air, and there's an antenna shooting off to the, you know, the sides that look like booms. And people think they're UFOs, and they are, but that's probably the, I don't know, 10th or 20th generation of the ionic craft that people are seeing. Some, it's been on the internet before. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about. But
no, I'd have to look that up. Do you know a site where we could go look that up?
No, I sure don't. Okay. I was on YouTube or something. I think somebody caught it flying around. But I think it might have been a model that somebody had designed, but it was pretty much man-made. But part of that was incorporated into the ram scoop that I designed. Then, of course, I had also kind of rotating magnetic flywheels inside the diffuser, and then an extension off of that would be some arms that were part of the emitter system that would... be like a helicopter that would rotate kind of clockwise and clockwise, and it would be actually magnetic as well, and had kind of rotating magnetic fields that would use for anti-grav, and also you could use the emitters if they're rotating in the atmosphere. They could work as you know, like a helicopter as well. And then after it left the atmosphere, of course, you could just use the free hydrogen in space. And I suggested, when I was with the National Space Institute, I suggested that they use the solar wind and the hydrogen off the solar wind to propel the ram scoops.
Mm-hmm. What did you do for NASA?
It wasn't NASA. It was the National Space Institute.
Oh, National Space Institute. Okay. What did
right. It wasn't tied in with NASA. It was... that was formed by Dr. Jerry O'Neill. I don't know if you know who Jerry O'Neill was, but he's the guy that designed the space colonies. You know, that there was a bunch of scientists and that we're working on that. You ever heard of L5? The L5 space colonies, L5
uh-huh.
Okay, so that the L5 Society is kind of a branch off of the National Space Institute. I forget what they call it now. It's got a different name. But this was back in the 70s when I was with those folks there. They came out with also kind of a magnetically propelled train. You know, they use electromagnets and to throw this train car down a rail, and it's the mass driver and the rail gun. They're all the same type of thing, but he used the mass driver instead of a rail gun, but he used it for a train. But they also were using the mass driver. They were going to use the mass driver to launch things off the Earth and off the Moon.
Yeah, I had seen that.
Yeah.
I know with the rail gun like you're talking about, you know, some people who play games might know and see on the games they have these rail guns that blow stuff up. But
yeah, the rail guns, what they are is a rail.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and it's got like a cart on it, if is the best way to look at it, or a container. And that's, remember STS-48, the space shuttle where it was up in orbit, and then you saw that UFO come in, and you saw something launched off the ground, that the UFO made
where the UFO makes a right turn. Get out of the way.
It flew out of there, and then you see the flash and the thing, you know,
mm-hmm.
the particles go out. Well, I'm pretty sure that was a rail gun, and they put what they call brilliant pebbles, probably cluster bombs, and so it was like a big shotgun shell.
I know that I've heard of different things where they've worked with these rail guns where they shoot a huge piece of steel, like miles.
Right.
And then... I know they use that technology for roller coasters, too. If you look at the side of a roller coaster, it has a little metal flap. And actually, I thought this was really interesting. It fits into, when you get into it, you can see it's fitting into something. They shoot it, launch it with one electromagnetic charge, and that's what launches you, and it's the propulsion for your entire roller coaster ride.
Right.
That one boom right at the beginning.
Yeah, and they can extrapolate that out, and they can make trains that work that mm-hmm. way, too. You know, and just every once in a while have a electromagnetic field that, you know, that
pushes it along.
Pushes it right down the road.
Cool.
That could be really pretty easy if they want to do that around highway, do a monorail, set it up that way, and put some coils in the road every once in a while, and then have the coils powered by solar panels, you know, photovoltaics, and they could, you know, you could have a train system that for commuters that would be really efficient, non-polluting, and all that sort of thing.
Yeah. So I wanted to cover some of your history and what you've worked on, but I'd also like to get into now, when did you get into UFOs and the UFO subject?
Well, when I was 10 years old, I had a close encounter.
Mm-hmm.
It was back in, I'm an old guy, 58. We had just moved into the house here, and I was 10 years old. I was born in 47, right after the Roswell crashes. And at 10 years old, I was sleeping in bed, and I woke up. I heard all these sirens going off. This is here in Denver. Right outside of, in 58, we were out in the country, pretty much out in the suburbs, you know. The Denver-Boulder Turnpike was just a two-lane road, and there was just four-way stops where all the overpasses are now. But I got up, and I heard all these sirens going off, and I wondered what was going on, and I could see through the shade on my window of my bedroom that there was all these flashes and stuff, so... I stood on the bed and pulled the shade back and put my head up there, and I looked out, and I could see it looked like all these big searchlights going across the sky over Denver.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw these Well, they were lights in the sky, and I didn't know what they were as a kid. Of course, back then, you know, UFOs were making the headlines in the papers and stuff, you know, flying saucers. That was news way back then. You don't see it now, but, you know, nobody reports that anymore, but the newspapers would pick up those stories. But I could watch these things flying across the sky, and they were trying to track them, you know, lock onto them with their searchlights. You know, this was still during the Cold War, of course. Korea just ended over, you know, up and back in 51. But so, you know, they had the whole defense system. And then pretty soon it all calmed down. And the next thing I know, a light came on my mom and dad's room, and they got up, and my dad was in his T-shirt and boxer shorts. My mom was in her nightgown, and they started walking down the hall towards the front door, and my sister got up too, and I said, wait for me. Mm-hmm. And I followed them out the front door, and we went out onto the front yard. Dad had just planted some grass and was coming up and told us not to walk on it, you know, because he just planted grass out there. But we walked out there, and I looked up and down the street, and everybody on both sides of the street were all standing out in the front yard with their night clothes and their bed clothes. And I couldn't figure out what the heck's going on. And mm-hmm. I grabbed hold of my dad's hand, and I said, Dad, what's going on? What's going on? And he was just looking straight ahead, like, you know, like he was sleeping, standing up with his eyes open. And I couldn't, everybody was just not responsive. And I thought this was strange. And, you know, I kind of got a little bit afraid, you know, I was thinking this is pretty scary. And then all of a sudden I heard a voice in my head that says, don't be afraid, Ricky. And I turned, and there was this guy, must have been, oh, I'd say he was about 10 feet tall. I was at 10 years old, I was about 4'10 or 5 feet tall at the time. I came right up about the guy's waist, and he was, you know, on my dad, I came up to my dad's chest, but my dad came up to, the, you know, just below that guy's chest, and he was tall. I could say he was at least 8 to 10, maybe 12 feet tall.
Wow.
And, yeah, he's standing right next to me, and he looked human, but only big. You know, he's a big human-looking guy. And he was wearing something that looked like, you know, like a kilt. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of like a all white, and kind of had like a gold border on it. And he was, it had been a, like a tunic on top of that, or a shirt, or whatever. And this stuff was all happening, and I couldn't figure out what's going on. I could see everybody out in the front yard, look down the street. Walking up the sidewalk, there's two more of these really tall guys, and there was a shorter one in the middle, and he was about my size, you know, around 5 feet tall, and he had something in his hand, you know, I don't know what it was, a clipboard, Palm Pilot, I don't know, something like that in his hand that he was checking on, and the two taller guys had something in their hands. I thought, you know, at the time I was 10, I was into comic books, you know. And I thought, oh, ray guns or something. But I now that what they were just handheld lights or something, or maybe it was what they used to
virtually. Tricorder, like in Star Trek.
I don't know what it was. Maybe it was what people were out in the front yard were sleeping, didn't know what was going on. Only I was the only one in the whole neighborhood that did. And so they came walking up to my street, and the guy says, it's okay, Ricky, and he pushed me forward, and the little guy in the middle says, oh, we already know all about him. So, and he turned and looked up and down the street and says, well, they can all go back into their houses. And so everybody walked inside their houses, and I got back into bed. We all got back into bed, and I went to sleep. And the next morning I woke up and ran out in the kitchen. It was in the summer. It was in June. 58, and I said, Mom, what was all the spacemen doing here, and why were we outside? And my mom says, what? I said, where's Dad? She says, oh, he's working. I said, where's my sister? And she says, she's still sleeping. And I said, well, what happened? She says, oh, honey, that was just a dream. So I thought that was just a dream until 73 when I had a close encounter and they took me up right to the living room, right up on board their craft, right to the ceiling. And that's another story.
So when did that story, when did was that memory?
Well, that actually happened. That was in, this was, I was working on a ramjet at the time, and I got stuck. This was in 73. And, you know, I was working up the propulsion system. You know, I had the whole Cherbysky first stage. It actually is three-stage fusing. You had the first stage was a Pons and Fleischmann type of reaction. And then the second stage was the Jones reaction. And then the third stage was the Dr. Forward reaction. And Dr. Forward was using metallic hydride pellets that absorb hydrogen. And then they use lasers to do a nuclear reaction, a fusion reaction. But only I went and condensed using lasers. I used hydrogen and it turned it into a snowball with a rock in the middle of it, which would be that pellet. And then it'd be ejected out into the exhaust gas. And then I had chemical lasers on the outside of the engine, and they would be focused on those pellets. And then they'd thermonuclear detonate and out in space, out behind it, and then push it forward, like the Dia Dallas project. And that's when I designed that at Laurie Air Force Base. That my fiance was regional director for the War College and attached with the Army out there.
Hmm.
And so Colonel saw it, and it got codenamed the Aurora because it was in Laurie Air Force Base in Aurora, Colorado.
Really?
It got classified, and that was when Ronald Reagan was president. You know, I sent it off. Well, actually, it was Jim Carter, and then I gave it to Ronald Reagan, and then after Reagan and Bush, you know, and I sort of gave the design theory out to people. But what happened under Reagan is that he got interested in it and put a classification on it. It got classified by NASA because it got off to NASA. But nobody could talk to me about it because I didn't have a classification. I didn't have a clearance.
Hmm.
So once it's classified, if you don't have a clearance, or you know, they won't talk to you.
So do you think that has something to do with what people call the Aurora Black Project crap?
I kind of do because especially, you know, when they see it flying, they have these smoke rings behind it.
Right.
Okay, so if you put the pellets into the exhaust gas and shoot it out the back end, and then I've got a ring of lasers that focus in onto those pellets behind it. And when it detonates, it kind of, you know, it'd be concentrated in the center there, and it'd blow outwardly like a circle.
Hmm.
So, yeah, where was I? I'm sorry.
You were talking about actually one of your experiences.
In 73. Yeah, so I got stuck. I just didn't know how the inside of this thing worked, you know, because you've seen how how the flying saucers, you know, they can do change directions almost, you know, 360 degree direction or 180 degree direction change all of a sudden, you know, without turning the bank and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering how they could do it because the G forces would really be heavy, and you know, people inside of it would really get mashed flat, you know, especially if you do an accelerated G turn, you know, when you're turning the bank, you know, you got really a lot of G forces on it. But if you can do transversal G's, the G forces are a lot lower. So I was wondering how to do that, and I kind of stuck on it. And then I my girlfriend dumped me, and you know, I kind of went in this grief period. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, and I was all bummed out, and my roommates were on a flight. And I'd just been working with United Airlines for about 6 months. So I just got off probation with them. And you know, during probation, if you look cross-eyed, they could lay you off and the unions wouldn't come up to you as part of the contract. So, you know, they could just let you go for any reason. So I was kind of in that mode. And so I to deal with my grief and my problems and all that, I do meditations. So my roommates were gone. It was summertime. It was hot, no air conditioning. And Washington, D.C. is in Annandale, Virginia. I was in my apartment. I got up and went out in the living room, sat down and did this meditation. And when I was doing this, I kind of did a self-hypnosis, you know, technique to get myself relaxed and into the state of consciousness that I could, you know, deal with my problems and that. And I'm a religious scientist, so I do a lot of science of mind work and meditations. So while I was doing that, I was thinking, well, since I haven't had much luck with Earth women in my life, maybe women from another planet would be a lot different. And all of a sudden, I kind of remote viewed this this scene of the sky, the moon in a cloud, and the moon shining through the cloud, and then it was kind of silver around the outside and a little bit darker in the center of this cloud. And then I saw this disc drop straight down inside this cloud and stop, you know. And so I'm doing this meditation. I got my eyes closed and everything. And all of a sudden, I feel myself, you know, pretty light. I can't feel the pressure of the floor where I'm sitting on it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I got my eyes closed, and all of a sudden, I can hear traffic. And I can hear the wind blowing by my ear, so I opened up my eyes, and here I was. Now, this is really high, strange stuff I'm talking about. And some of my experiences, you know, if it was me telling me, I wouldn't believe it, but I got to believe it because it happened to me, you know. So I opened my eyes, and here I was floating about about 6 or 7 feet above the roof of my apartment building. I was on it was a three-story building, and my apartment was on the third floor. And there I was about 6, 7 feet, just sort of sitting in the lotus position for people who know about meditation. And I was, you know, sitting there cross-legged and just floating. And I was going, wow, this is strange. And I looked and I could see Duke Street, which Little River Turnpike, which ran right by the Mayfair apartments there, right off of the Beltway out in D.C., I-95 in the Beltway. That's pretty much where we were. And I was looking, wow, this must be, I'm levitated here. This is cool. My mom will love this. And I'm watching the cars drive up and down the street, and then one pulled into the drive to get into this apartment complex. And this apartment complex was really large. It had three-story apartments that covered up the whole side of the block, and they were connected with breezeways, you know,
mm-hmm.
from one building to another, and there's parking in the front. Then in the center was an Olympic-sized swimming pool with a clubhouse and grassy area and parking around the pool. And then on three sides, one side was my apartment, three rows of apartments. Another side was three rows. Another side was three rows. But straight across from me was what they called Mayfair Towers, and that was about a 12-story apartment, you know, high-rise with underground parking. That's where all the rich guys, I wasn't that rich at the time. But so there I was, and the cars are pulling in the drive, and I'm going, wow, this is really neat. You know, I'm looking around, how am I doing this? And then all of a sudden, I started going higher up in the air. And I said, well, I'm not doing this consciously. You know, I'm not trying to do this.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, I looked around me, and here was this, I was inside this blue light. And it was like a cone of light, a vortex of light. And I could see around the edges of it was kind of like, it was like a laser spinning around counterclockwise, and the light that I was in was blue, but around the edges was kind of like a magenta color or a violet color. you know, around the edge of this, this cone of light, and it was an inverted cone. And I was raising up inside of it, and I said, well, I wonder where this light's coming up. And I looked up, and there was that cloud I saw on my remote view. It was right above me, and I could see the moon shining through it. And I go, wow, this is just like I looked at just a while ago. And in the center of it was a dark oval-shaped object. And this blue beam of light was coming out of that object that was in this cloud. And I just floated right up into this object. And the next thing I knew, I was inside this thing about the size of an aircraft hangar. And it was all white inside, lit up bright. And I was there in my birthday suit. It was hot. And that kind of, you know, stranged me out. But I could see something look like a pressure door. And I could see the superstructure of this, you know, those beams and stuff inside of it. And so I was sitting there on this floor, and I got up, and I walked over there, and I looked in this little window that was in this pressure door. And I could see what looked like a control deck. And I could see what looked like human-looking women. And they were quite attractive. And, you know, they looked like they were about my age. I was about 23 or 24 at the time. But they were wearing these turquoise, like, jumpsuits, real form-fitting, almost kind of like, diving, you know, wetsuits.
Uh-huh.
Not only they were turquoise. Turquoise blue and kind of shiny looking. And this one, they were all sitting at control panels, and I could see these lights flashing on and off. And this one was kind of walking around. She had kind of long chestnut colored hair, and I'm going, wow, this is great. I always want to be on board one of these things. And I'm here as an astral projection during my meditation. And they don't know I'm here because this is not my physical body. This is just my astral body, and, you know, I'm doing a remote view. And as soon as I thought that, they all looked at me. You know, their heads turned in unison, and I'm like, looked at me, and I go, wow, I'm busted looking in the window at these gals. So I dropped to the floor, and I'm like, oh, my God, here I am, you know, completely, totally vulnerable. You know, there's no cover at all. And I said, I've got to get out of here. So I initiated myself to wake up from this meditation because it was too real. And so all of a sudden I found myself back in my apartment, and I kind of in the same position that I'd started before. And I thought, wow, I'm so relieved that I'm back here. And this was just, you know, I'd gone to sleep during this meditation, and it was just a dream, and it wasn't real. And, you know, I was pretty much relieved. My blood pressure started to drop, you know, from that. And then all of a sudden, I could hear this high-frequency hum coming through the ceiling of my apartment. And it sort of was a humming, buzzing kind of sound combined with a like you'd pull on a vacuum sweeper hose, you know, along the carpet, you know, and kind of made that sound. And I could hear it coming over the roof of my apartment building, like I said, on the top floor. And I could hear it do a Doppler shift as it moved over. The drapes were open. We had these big French doors that kind of opened up and went on to a balcony. It was about 14 feet long. It was a big plate, you know, covered the whole living room. And the drapes were open, and I could see the stars, and the moon was, you know, lit it up in the moonlight. And all of a sudden, I could hear it coming through the ceiling, and I looked up the ceiling. Of course, I couldn't see anything through the ceiling, but I could hear it moving across. So I turned my head, and I looked through the French door there, and this dark object was kind of like a round dark object, just started moving over and blocking out the whole, you know, this part of the sky, and then it got bigger and bigger, and then all of a sudden it blocked out the whole skylight, and, you know, the whole star field. And this thing, I was freaked out. It's, wow, they tracked, my spirit back to my body or homed in into my thoughts, you know. And then right away I knew there was nowhere I could hide from these people. And I thought that, you know, they were tracking me down for being on board this craft, you know.
Yeah.
And I was busted and I was in big trouble now. And so I said, oh, no. And then all of a sudden the outside, that whole block I told about, all those apartments, the Olympic Slice pool and everything, this was like 3 o'clock in the morning. It was pretty dark out, and all of a sudden it just lit up like noon. I mean,
wow.
That's the way it was, like the sun just turned on and lit up the whole block. And I go, whoa. So I didn't know what to do. Where are you going to hide, you know? If they can track down your thoughts, they can home in on you anywhere. Forget the implants. They can record your brain waves, and they know who you are and where you're at. That doesn't matter. So, you know, I was kind of freaked myself out. Of course, there was no hostile intentions on them. I mean, they weren't all that invasive. They were pretty curious about me, I think. And so I hid behind the chair, and I was looking over the arm of the chair, and all of a sudden something dropped down out of this whatever it was. It was over the top of, you know, over the top of the mothership or whatever it was, because it was big, you know, it covered up a whole city block. And it dropped down, and it all of a sudden came right in front of the balcony, and it turned on. It was like somebody turning on a carbon arc searchlight and lighting up all the inside of my apartment. And I go, whoa. So I said, I can't believe this is happening. This is really happening. And,
when you thought you were in trouble for peeping in on their space babes.
Yeah, you know, in my birthday suit to boot. You know? And so I go, oh, my God. What? I can't believe this is happening. So I said, oh, no. I said, I know I my whole life I wanted to go with these guys. I know I want to go. I can't go, though. I just can't handle it. It was just too much of a thing to know that they were here and I could go with them if I really wanted to. And I said, oh, I can't handle this right now. I don't know. Like, this is happening. Yeah, it's really happening. I don't know. And so I just said, oh, I started thinking. I contacted, I believe in guardian angels, and my grandfather had passed over. And I said, you know, just go to him and tell him I'm really glad you're here and I want to go, but I just can't handle it right. I can't go. And so the light went off, and it retracted back into this large craft, and the lights went out. And I looked out the window. I, you know, finally had enough courage to look over the armrest of the chair and get closer to the window there to look out. And I could see that there was something hanging down from this larger portion of the craft. It was like a gondola hanging down, you know, from the main body of the craft.
Mm-hmm.
And the craft started, it moved, it just moved sideways about, about a couple hundred feet maybe, or 100 feet, and it moved sideways. And the reason it moved sideways because it was keeping the same level, but this gondola thing that was hanging down, if it would have kept going straight, it would have crashed into the high rise on the other side of the pool. So it moved further enough south that it would, you know, could pass by the high rise. The bigger body of the craft itself was high enough in the air that, you know, it wouldn't hit the high rise, but the gondola part that was hanging down would have. So it moved sideways a little bit, and then it started moving off. And I wanted to get a good visualization of it. And I was trying. It was at night, of course. You know, there's no really, your cones in your eyes don't work that well for color, but your rods do, and for black and white. And I was trying to get a depth perception and a light to find out what color this thing was. And the best thing I could do was the trees that were there. So it was like, it's either black or it was a dark forest, you know, forest green color, this craft. And it moved off, and the gondola part, I could see it had like big windows in it. Imagine a garage door, you know. but only they had like a black film over it, like on the back of the Polaroid picture. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Polaroids. Well, it was kind of like a film. It was over these windows, and these windows were kind of like a garage door. So, you know, it was big enough that somebody could stand in it, you know, like a double car garage door. And these windows kept going by me, and it looked like if you ever been parked at a railroad crossing, you know, where the train comes by.
Yeah.
And you see the cars, how they kind of come by.
Right.
Sort of
whizzing by you.
Well, those windows went by like that, and it took about 10, 15 seconds for that part of the gondola to move away and the craft to get further enough away from me, you know. So the gondola part just moved off, but the main body of the craft was still moving. And all of a sudden, it finally got far enough away and was still really close to the ground, within 100 feet, a couple hundred feet anyway. And it narrowed down, and I could see the back end of this craft. And it kind of looked like a kind of mushroom shaped, or if you take your, or maybe like a Hershey's Kiss, you know, the back end of it. And it was all black, but right in the center of it was this turquoise blue, looked like a big crystal that was rotating like a dryer drum at the laundromat, and it was rotating like counterclockwise. So this big turquoise, or maybe blue topaz or sapphire, I don't know what you want to call it, crystal was rotating counterclockwise. And I could see the facets in this thing. I thought, wow, that's pretty amazing. But it was blue. And the thing, I don't know, was about that crystal thing that I saw rotating was about, I don't know, 30 or 40 feet across.
Wow.
And it got far enough away. And then all I could see was this big blue globe, you know, floating off. And then I was, you know, just mesmerized on this thing. And then it either went and dropped down and landed, or went behind a hill, or turned right or something, and then I couldn't see it anymore. Or maybe it just went into stealth mode and was gone. But anyway, it just sort of disappeared.
So
I thought, wow, this is something. So I turned on the radio real quick. Mm-hmm. No, this was over Washington, D.C. You know, this was inside the Beltway. Somebody's got to have seen this thing, you know. Nothing on the radio, nothing in the newspapers. And I went to 7-Eleven across the street going to get the morning edition because I thought it would be in the newspaper. I walked out there, and there was the Potomac Gas and Light truck was out there because this thing blew up a transformer on the pole right next door to my apartment building. So
wow.
They were out putting in a new transformer because it knocked out the transformer.
So some of these terms you use, like because you were 23 and this was the 70s,
yeah.
Right? So, for instance, remote viewing, is that a term, or even astral body? Were those terms you knew back then?
The remote view, I didn't really know about. The astral stuff I did.
Yeah, so you're kind of using remote view to just kind of, as a term now, as to what you were doing. But back then, you didn't know that term, so you were just kind of out there in your meditation.
Yeah, it was an astral projection.
Mm-hmm.
Because my mother's she's a clairvoyant, clairaudient type of person. So we grew up in you know, that type of spirituality.
Right.
Because she could see things like that, and she was also a transmedium, and we'd have people come through her and talk through her, you know, and train us how to do meditations and a lot of different techniques. And we learned a lot about meditations and cosmologies just through my mom, and people would come through her and teach us. And there was an ET when I was growing up that my mom used to see all the time. She said he had the silver suit on and everything. And so, yeah. So I was kind
of... What did she say it looked like?
Well, she said it looked, it was a, we just called him the spaceman, and he looked, had a, like a silver suit on, shiny silver suit.
So he looked like a human?
Yeah, you know, you did, two arms, two legs, and a head, you know, nothing
mm-hmm.
that would have freaked anybody out.
Mm-hmm.
But she said he's by you, and she said, she told me when I was growing up, a kid, that I was, you know, here for doing some special work and stuff out here.
Mm. So when did you find out about CSETI and their protocols?
Well, okay, I came out with my designs theory, and I got it all finished and polished up, because right after that encounter in D.C., I told you I was stuck on a design theory. And then a couple days later, I had an aha, and then I knew how it worked. It was right after that UFO contact, I knew how I had the breakthrough, and I knew I just finished the thing off then, because I was doing a lot of concentration. I'd meditate, trying to look at a UFO, you know, like a flying saucer, and figure out how it worked. I was doing, like Einstein said, the gedanken, and thinking about it. And theorizing how it worked, and you know, and I finally had the breakthrough, and then I just sat down and I wrote the whole design out longhanded, and then I polished it up in 76, 77. That's when I handed it off to the Army, and then Ronald Reagan and all, and then also from United Airlines, I told them about it,
mm-hmm.
and they. German board gave me a corporate accommodation, and they're going to send me up to CU to go to grad school, but CU said that what I was working on was, you know, the perpetual motion machine and all that. And so I knew right away that those guys were going to do a thing about it, and contacted CBS News. CBS lawyers, they wanted to build it, but the one I had designed was interstellar, and it was 100 feet in diameter. And I figured it would take $1 billion in 10 years in R&D before we get the thing working.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the end of that. But, you know, $1 billion in $77 or $78 is a lot of money. It's a lot of money now, probably about $10 billion now. But anyway, so I kept going with it. And I met with Carl Sagan through Planetary Society on the Big Island in Kona. And I was going to hand it off to him, and he said, well, you know, he looked at it like he knew it from before. He might have seen it before. And we know now that Sagan was involved in a covert way. But anyway, he said, send it to me at Cornell. So I sent it to him at Cornell, and, you know, he never got back to me about it. It kind of gave me the brush off. And then Dr. Brian O'Leary, you know Brian O'Leary?
Mm-hmm.
He is Apollo Mars astronaut, and he was deputy director under Sagan. He was Apollo Mars, and they were doing findings from the Mars Mariner, and they were trying to find landing sites on Mars. And then, of course, O'Leary was deputy director at the JPL under Sagan on the Mars Viking lander, on the Viking project. You know, everybody's familiar with the Viking orbit, take the photograph, the face on Mars, that whole bit, and then it landed and, you know, scooped up some soil and tried to see if there's any life in the soil sample that they had.
Mm-hmm.
But Brian got the imagings back from three different angles that, you know, they do the mosaics. They fly over and take photographs of Viking wood, and then they send them back, and they would do all these passes and make a mosaic, and they put them together, and they look what the surface was, and then they send it over to these guys in the lab, and they take the images and at different angles they could get elevations, and they did the topography maps, and they're going to make a topographical globe of Mars and all that. And so Dr. Carlotto was involved in that the topographical imaging and doing the mapping of it. And so he got a hold of O'Leary and told O'Leary, hey, look, here's the face on Mars, and it looks like it's a possible anomaly because we got three different sun angles on it. And then everybody's familiar with Hoagland's dissertation on the face on Mars, you know. and cities on Mars sort of thing. But O'Leary was there, and yeah, he saw it, and he did some logarithmic studies of it and sent a paper off to Sagan saying that, look, there's some anomaly, the possible anomalies here, and here's the calculations on it, and we should look at this. And of course, Sagan, he was part of the cover, and he said, well, no, management's already decided that that was just light and shadowing, so they didn't even look at O'Leary's calculations on it, and the documentation that Carlotto brought forward. And so, you know, then Nixon cut the space program and cut Apollo and cut Mars Apollo. I was in Navy flight school. I was trying to get into the Apollo project to go to Mars myself. And then after Nixon cut the program, I was really disgruntled about all of that. But anyway, it's a long story. So I met O'Leary, Dr. O'Leary, at a UFO conference in Phoenix. And I went up to him and said, you know, Sagan gave me the brush off just like he did you, because I read O'Leary's book about it. And and I said, yeah, I was trying to do this and that, and here's my design theory for the three-stage fusion electromagnetic ram scoop, you know, flying saucer. And he took a look at it, and then he said, well, send it to Dr. Murray Albertson up at CSU. He's the vice president of research and development there, and also civil engineering chair up there. And he takes a look at it, and he approves it, and he says, we're going to have a conference up at CSU in the International Forum on New Science, and if it's approved, you can give an international presentation there. And I said, oh, great. So this is in 90 and 91. They scheduled the forum, and Dr. Albinson gave me an approval to give that presentation. So I said, great. So I went to Fort Collins, and of course, I didn't really have, I didn't have a computer. Well, the computers back in 91 were, you know, not so good. But anyway, I didn't have transparencies and all that stuff like the other guys did. But so I gave my presentation in the morning. Leo Sprinkles was there. He sat in on it, and a lot of different people were there. And then in the afternoon, I looked at the schedule, and I saw this Dr. Stephen Greer was giving a presentation about the CSETI, Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and he's giving his documentation about the contact and CE5 work, human-initiated contact, and what was going down in Gulf Breeze, Florida, you know, outside of Pensacola. It's right across the bridge from Pensacola. And when I was in the Navy, that's where I went to flight school, there in Pensacola. So, you know, I knew the area pretty well. And then, it was Ed Walters, you know, his stuff down in Gulf Breeze. And so Greer was down there in the 80s. And also he was in Belgium when they had the big flap in Belgium with the big triangles. He was over there, too, working with the Belgian Air Force. So he had all this documentation, and he was giving a presentation. And then I found out later that in 73, he was in Asheville, North Carolina, in about November, and he had this craft come over, and he had made contact similar to my experience in 73. And I said, wow, we've had the same sort of thing, you know, and I said, we got to get together. And so that's what happened.
Mm-hmm, and that's when it started. When did the CSETI project start?
Well, so in 73, Dr. Greer was, you know, he was he's kind of a smart. He's got an IQ about 186 and photographic memory. So he was going to school down in North Carolina, and he was took a hike up in the mountains, and he'd do meditations. You know, he was teaching Sanskrit before he started his doctorate in his medical career. He was with the Maharishi University in Haifa, Israel, and he was teaching Sanskrit and meditation, transcendental meditation at the Maharishi University there. And I think maybe here in the United States, I'm not quite sure. You have to ask him about that. But anyway, so he was walking up a mountain and did a meditation and that sort of thing. And when he was doing the meditation, he remembered back to when he was a kid about this ET contact that he had. And so he kind of tried to make contact again during this meditation to let him know that, you know, if they were still around and if they remembered him and so on and so forth. And then all of a sudden, he came out of this meditation and stood up, and then he felt something poking him, on, like a finger poking him on the arm, and he looked down, and here this ET was. And so they communicated, and they took him on board a craft, and he went.
What did he say that this creature looked like, or was it another human looking?
Well, this was a short one. I don't recall.
Mm.
You'd have to talk to him about. You know, I don't want to say something about it. It's probably better if you talk to him. You know, on all this stuff, because you know I don't want to. If you look at that update, you got the update from the Disclosure Project down the bottom. There's an email address that you can. I think it's media@disclosureproject.org. It's an email address, and
okay,
you can write to that, and he'll do an interview with you if you want.
But yeah, anyway, I definitely want to bring him on eventually.
Yeah. So anyway, that's when it was that contact happened with him. They took him to the moon, and you know, at the terminator of the moon, that this there was this huge craft there that was actually had a power link to the surface of the moon at the terminator on the moon. And this thing was huge, and it had all these other ET craft inside of it. And so it was there that he worked out with the ETs the C-SETI contact protocols.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that whole history of how he came up with that.
So he worked it out and then kind of dropped it until after, you know, he got into his medical career and stuff. But then that was in the 70s when he's, you know, he worked all that out. And then I might be a little bit fuzzy on the timeline. That's where it's better for you to talk to him about. So, you know,
well, cool. We're almost out of time. But yeah, I got a hold of that protocol, and I've been into meditation for quite some time, and I was a little skeptical, to be honest. And but I went out to the UFO Watchtower for the first time. I brought the noise that they use from the protocol. Kind of sounds like crickety, but it's in a they got it from a crop circle. So and we did. Luckily, someone from who was involved with CSETI came by. We tried the protocol. And sure enough, 30 minutes later, there was this really bright light that flew over the Sangre de Cristos, over the sand dunes there, and then steadily faded out directly east of us. And that was the first time I ever saw what I would call a UFO. So we're almost out of time. You know, your stories were really interesting. That's why I wanted to hear them all. So I think people will love those. I was hoping we'd be able to get into more, but it was really fascinating stuff, and actually I've already got to say goodbye, so thanks for being on the show.
You're welcome.
You know, I think UFO Adventure is a good title because you certainly had a very interesting history, and I guess in the last 30 seconds, if you can tell us, you know, what's your future? What are you looking forward to doing in the future here?
Right now, Dr. Greer is going to be giving a lecture down at the Metro State at the Turn Hall on the 18th from 7 o'clock to around 9:30. And so it's going to be that's on June 18th, so, you know, stop by if you can, and all your listeners as well. It's $10 to get in. Then on the 20th, he's going to do a workshop, Dr. Greer. We're going to teach the C-SETI protocols during the day from about 1 to about dinner time. And then we're going to meet out in the field. We've got a field site all picked out, and we're going to go through the C-SETI protocols that we have that you would learn during that workshop, and then go ahead and make contact out in the field like you were talking about with the tones and everything. And then that's on the 20th. Then on the 21st, we're heading down to Crestone for a whole week. Doing the C-SETI training there. So, uh, CSETI.org. You can find out all about it with links to the disclosure.
All right. Well, thank you. We'll talk to everybody next week. We are out of time.
Yeah, I'm still here.
I don't know why this.